La Polonia, la Scozia, la Georgia, Gibilterra.
Republic of Irlanda.
The Republic of Ireland will join Group D. The team of Mr. O'Neill will play Germany, Republic of Ireland, Poland, Scotland, Georgia, and Gibraltar. Ivo, what do you think for Polska? Good?
Very good.
Very good. Very good. Careful. He's very good.
We've got Scotland, yeah. We've got Poland, Georgia as well, too, as if they're coming out of pot five. So a difficult group, but exciting nevertheless. It is tough. I'm sure there are other groups that we might have preferred to have been in, but nevertheless, get on with it, and exciting, as you say.
It's been called many things: the tough group, the group of booze, the feisty group. One thing's for sure, it'll be a very exciting group. Germany, Poland, Scotland, Georgia, and newcomers Gibraltar stand in O'Neill's way of guiding Ireland to the promised land. He's picked his first squad. Who's in, who's out? We've got it right here on the Why Big Football Show. I'm Dave O'Grady. We're delighted to be making our debut on Freak FM. You can listen to the show at 10 p.m. every Tuesday. That's Freak FM, FRQ.FM. You should also download the Freak FM mobile app. To contact the show, email dave@talkingsport.org. We're also at talkingsport.org on Twitter, or you can just search for Dave O'Grady on Twitter and you'll find me. Well, we're going to be looking at the team picked by Martin O'Neill shortly. We'll also be chatting to UEFA coach Antonio Mantero about the way forward for youth football in Ireland. But first, we're delighted to be joined on the Why Big Football Show with Irish Times football correspondent Emmet Malone, who's constantly on the go. Emmet, thanks a million for taking our call. Not quite the group of death or the group of life, but for fans, certainly the group of fun and excitement.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Dave. It's somewhere, I guess, in between what you know, as good or as bad as it could have been. It's a tough group. I think first place is fairly clearly accounted for. But it's an interesting three-way battle, or if you're to believe the managers involved, a four-way battle for second and third place. And, you know, Ireland will certainly be in the mix there, and they'll have very few complaints if they can't secure at least a third place and be involved beyond the group stages.
Yeah, in your own opinion, Emmet, obviously, as you said, second place is the most realistic goal for us. I think everybody will agree Germany will win the group. Would you go along with the general consensus that we will be there at a level playing field for second place with Poland and Scotland? Or do you think what a lot of optimistic people say, that we might be we're a little bit ahead of these teams, and with the grit and determination and a little bit of flair, we can actually take that second spot?
I think there's a lot up for grabs, to be honest. I'd say on balance, Poland probably have better players than us. Certainly their best players are better than our best players. And so I think from that point of view, you know, we're probably in a situation where certainly the grit and determination has to count for something. We have to see more, you know, the new management team get more out of the team than we've seen in the last, you know, year or so. We're going to have to start beating some of these teams at home. Beating serious rivals at home is going to be a priority, which we haven't done that in a while still maintaining some of the kind of the grit away from home that grinds out results in tough situations. So, look, I don't know. If I was betting man, I would put Poland a slight favourite to second place and us a slight favourite to third. But, you know, look, if you look at the results of the last campaign, Scotland and ourselves both finished fourth in groups. What would alarm me about the comparison with Scotland is that they started their group terribly poorly, but finished it strongly, beating Croatia home and away. That's something that we probably couldn't have managed over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, seeded teams, I think, Emmet, have really been a problem for us. Talk of Scotland, Ireland, Celtic Park, a special arena for a special occasion, potentially. We haven't played them in a competitive match since the qualifiers for Euro 88.
Yeah, it's a long, long time, isn't it? And they haven't qualified for anything at all, since '98. So, you know, they'll be excited. They'll see this group as something under Strachan. They view him much the same way we view O'Neill, as somebody who can come in and generate a new enthusiasm in the team, get more out of players, play an attacking brand of football. So, you know, I think expectations will be pretty high going there late this year. The campaign will still be young and everyone will be kind of full of hope. So, yeah, it should be a really terrific occasion.
The games against Poland, Emmet, we've seen what their fans bring when they come to Dublin. A lot of the Polish fans that actually go supporting Ireland, they'll be trading their green jerseys for the red and white of Poland. Will this be like two home games for Poland?
It's going to be interesting, all right. I mean, if you go back to the Crow Park game where we played them in, under Staunton, I mean, the friendly there was amazing. You know, the number of Poles who turned out for it. Obviously, I think it's fair to say the population isn't quite what it was at that stage. But, you know, there's still a lot of Poles living in Ireland. A lot of people have settled there. And it's a great mix of the community. So, you know, their community has settled really, really incredibly well. So I think those will be great occasions. And again, I think they'll be very optimistic about it. They have, you know, players at really top clubs in the Bundesliga, really high quality players who haven't really produced. I mean, the last campaign for them was very, very disappointing. They were in a tough group, but they missed, passed up opportunities to do a little better in it than they did. And maybe the top players didn't deliver in the way they would have hoped. I think they should be very good occasions. I think it's a good one for the FAI because certainly they need, again, it'll be a big thing in this campaign for the team to be performing in such a way that it's competitive, that it's, you know, they're right in there for, you know, the race for qualification and that they're filling Lansdowne Road again. And I think if they turn that corner and fill Lansdowne Road a few times in a row, it would be a huge boost for them because you'll kind of get that sense back. That a ticket for an international game is something to cherish, and you know, people won't be deciding at 6 o'clock in the evening whether they wander along to the game.
Exactly.
They'll have to be committing to the long term, and that'll make a huge difference to the finances of the FAI, and you know, getting Poland, getting Scotland, while they're tough games or whatever, they're attractive. They have they'll attract locals, you know, from those nations who are based in Ireland, and so in every way, these are positive things for the association.
And the Georgia match, should it be taken for granted, Emmett? I mean, no doubt they'll be looking for a point to prove, kicking things off against us in Tbilisi. Will they have a bit of a score to settle? I know the last time the match was moved to Mainz in Germany for political reasons, and then again, you mentioned the match in Crow Park. They'll feel they were kind of robbed that day, almost getting a penalty that they shouldn't have. They'll really want to take something out of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're an interesting team. I mean, on the face of it, they don't have too many stars, but they're very well organized. And if you look back at their campaign last time, they drew at home to France, which is, you know, a decent enough achievement any time of the day. And they weren't in a very tough group. Spain were in it as well. They didn't lose any game by more than two goals, which is you know, pretty organized. I think I'm right in saying they only conceded 10 goals over the course of 8 games. I mean, they will be tough for us, you know. As you say, they bring a bit of baggage to the table. When we played them before, there was lobbying went on by the FAI to have the game moved out of Georgia. They wanted to keep it there despite the trouble that there was with Russia at the time. They were quite aggrieved about that. They got a friendly in Dublin out of it as part of a kind of, you know, an attempt to placate them. But they weren't happy about it, and I think they'll really be up for that game. Most likely in Tbilisi, it's not absolutely certain, but that's going to be the away game in particular is going to be a really tough one. It's probably going to be one that we need to get something out of, but the home game is it has to be really a must win. If we're not beating, you know, the fourth seeds in groups of 5 seeds, in fact, in a group, then you know, I think we're in really big trouble.
And Gibraltar, the unknown package, playing their home games in Faro in Portugal, a great trip for the Irish fans, but again, as you said, probably a must win. They're the San Marino of the group almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any way we can count on it kind of dropping points against Gibraltar. I mean, I spoke to their manager yesterday and was pretty taken aback at the idea that he was targeting a playoff place. We had Brian Kerr, who's in charge of the Faroes, and his mantra was that he had to get them to get a point, then to get a win, and to build confidence, to build ability, to build experience on the international scene. And I can't see how... I can't see how Gibraltar really have anything more than that to aim for in this campaign. They need to go out there. They need to try and get a point on the board. They need to try and make, you know, some sort of mark that they can build on going forward. But having to play in Faro is terrible for them. I mean, one of the big things that go for these teams is you know, playing in small stadiums with crowds really close to the pitch. You know, oftentimes the facilities are quite poor and a little bit ramshackle, and all of that counts for them. In their case, they're building an 8,000 seat stadium in Gibraltar, which will be ready for the next campaign. In the meantime, they're going to a 30,000 seat stadium in Faro. every team they'll play almost will have more fans than them there. Their manager's talking about the fact it's a grass pitch and, you know, that's terrific and everything like that. But, you know, this stuff will all suit the big teams that they're playing. Our guys will be used to going to 30,000 seat stadiums and feel completely relaxed there. I just really can't see any way that if we drop points from that, that it's not going to cost us very, very dearly.
Yeah, and just finally, Emmett, before I let you go, initial predictions for the Euros. I mean, is it going to be a case where Germany will win out and the likes of us, Poland and Scotland, will end up drawing with each other, or do you think we can make that final step and get there?
I really hope so. I mean, I think, you know, one of the big selling points for O'Neill and Keane as a team is the positivity that they're supposed to bring. And I hope we see that translate into the attitude that they bring on the pitch and that the players adopt. I think that any points gained against Germany, even a point at home, will be a major plus. Any points dropped against the lower teams, obviously Gibraltar, but certainly, you know, Georgia as well. We should beat them at home. We need to get something out there because I think other teams will. That they're important. Then the games against our main rivals, the main two rivals, are absolutely crucial. And we need, I would say, to be winning the home games, at least one of them, and getting resulted away. I mean, it sounds daft, but you know, we've just got to get a lot of points on the board here. I worry about the Poles in this group because I think that they'll be able to score goals. Whether Strachan can maintain the improvement that he brought when he took over the Scotland team, I'm not so sure. But certainly on the strength of the second half of the last campaign and some of the younger players they have, they look like a team who could improve. I think it's going to be very, very tough, but you know, it's doable. And if we don't do it with the expanded tournament that we and the Scots fought for, then we won't have any complaints.
Yeah, we certainly won't deserve to go there. Emmett Malone, thanks a million for joining me on the Why Big Football Show.
It's a pleasure, Dave.
You're listening to the Why Big Football Show on Freak FM. Get involved with the show. Email dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook. Chat to you soon.
You're very welcome back to the Why Big Football Show on Freak. I'm delighted to be joined now by three cracking journalists. Ger McCarty of the Irish Examiner, Ronan Murphy, a fantastic journalist altogether. He's involved with Goal, among a lot of other things. And making probably his debut or maybe his second appearance on the show is Trevor Keane of Sports News Ireland. Lads, you're all very welcome. Trevor, I'll start with yourself. Obviously, we've seen the Irish squad announced in Limerick by Martin O'Neill there last week. What did you make of it? Not really very surprising. Few omissions, it's probably fair to say. We don't. A lot of people were expecting Stephen Ireland to be named. Maybe a return of Shay Given and perhaps a couple of the younger lads, the likes of Eunan O'Kane and Jack Grealish in there. But he's kind of played it safe almost.
Yeah, I suppose that. I mean, that, you know, just on Shay Given, and I think we're probably better off looking to the future and you know, maybe giving Randolph a chance. You know, at he's had a good season. So, you know, he's probably had a better time of it than Ford. You know, I know Shay's been a great servant to Ireland, but I mean, we're probably at a stage where we need to be planning for the future. And I don't know how long, you know, Shay has left in him. I mean, if he would make it to 2016. So, you know, I think it's good to see Randolph in there, and Aaron Randolph. And I hope he gets a chance there. I mean, in terms of the squad itself, I mean, for me, a kind of surprising there was probably maybe Darren Murphy. I mean, probably thought his chance, you know, had gone. I'm looking forward to seeing hopefully Richard Keogh getting a chance at the back.
I think Richard Keogh, that's a fair point, because he's been captain of Derby County and a lot of good performances. It's a long time coming for him to get a chance.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, he's been kind of knocking on the door for the last time, and he's made last while, and he's kind of made the step up in the you know, certainly this season, and certainly under McLaren and Derby. I know they did a bit of a kind of a shaky start to 2014 after a great run, but they look kind of in good form again, and they're tapping on the heels of Burnley in there. So, you know, it's good to have players that are getting winning games and challenging for promotions, and that positive feel can only do well for the squad. So it's good to have him in there, and hopefully he gets a chance, you know.
Ronan, to come to yourself on what Trevor was mentioning there, he feels that Shay Given, I think that ship has sailed at this stage, although he has been involved with Middlesbrough and playing quite well, a couple of life-saving saves he's been making for Middlesbrough. But would you go along with Trevor there? The ship has sailed. And also, he mentioned Richard Keogh, a player that has been doing well and, as I said, captain of Derby County. What did you make of those inclusions?
Yeah, I definitely think Trevor is right with the Shea Given decision. All right, is there any point in looking at him at all, especially with the fact his loan at Middlesbrough is coming to an end this weekend, I think, in fact. So for the rest of the season, he's probably going to end up sitting on the bench or even worse with Villa. So if he does go back and doesn't get another move. So he's right to look at Darren Randolph, and Rob Elliott is the only on-cap player in the squad. So maybe he'll even get run out against Derby, you never know. And for the second point, the Richard Keogh thing, I think it is the perfect time to give someone else an opportunity. Maybe Richard Dunn might end up being one of the players cut from the 29, because we know exactly what Richard Dunn can do. And like Shea Given and Robbie, he's coming to the end of his Irish career. So Richard Keogh would be a good choice. But I was kind of surprised that Shane Duffy wasn't included, seeing as how he's captaining the under-21s and he's... according to most reports, he's doing very well at Yeovil despite their poor standing in the championship. It's a great experience for him on loan from Everton. That kind of back to the wall, panicky thing, approach to football, that maybe that's what we're used under Trapattoni the last 2 years.
Indeed.
So someone like Shane Duffy could be, that could be great experience for him for the road ahead.
I think that's a key point about Shane Duffy, Ronan. We have seen, I think he's 6'6", a huge man, and perhaps there is a future there. Roberto Martinez at Everton had come out saying that he hadn't forgotten him, they are monitoring him, and there's definitely a future there. So if he was to get back into that Everton side, that would be a huge stepping stone back into this Irish team. But as you said, you know, he's been doing very well for Yeovil, and it can only go upwards. Do you think that it will be cut down when the provisional squad is cut down, that we won't see Richard Dunn in there?
Well, I think if... of the most obvious ones, he probably is one that's likely to be cut. Maybe there's always the usual Twitter backlash every time Paul Green makes a squad, but I'd say he might be another that's unlucky to miss out. I'd say all the wingers will be kept because there's not a lot of options there. So there's probably more room to cut the central players, maybe a central defender or two, central midfielder, and maybe Simon Cox or might miss out up front. I doubt Daryl Murphy will miss out, especially on his return after such a long exile.
Yeah, Trevor, just to come back to you, and Ronan mentioned the point about there's always a bit of a Twitter backlash when Paul Green is, which is no fault of his own, because he's there to do a job, and we've seen under Trapattoni's tactics, Paul Green was provided with the platform to really flourish for Trapattoni in that situation. But would players like Chris McCann for Wigan maybe feel that they could have got in there? Eunan O'Kane, as I mentioned earlier, a young player doing terrific stuff at Bournemouth this season.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Green is probably one of these guys that, you know, that's vilified for simply opening his front door. I mean, he's, you know, I suppose he was good against Poland. He was probably one of the better performers. He's there to kind of, you know, do a job and break up play, you know, sit in the defensive midfield role. But I suppose, you know, with a team that has aspirations of kind of, you know, not just, you know, finishing third in their group and hopefully, you know, and getting in, just to nearly the equivalent of the back door for the Euros. But, you know, getting that first and second place, you need to be looking at, you know, a better quality of player. I mean, you know, Green has, you know, he struggled at times at his clubs to kind of be, you know, a regular. And, you know, I'd like to see David Myler maybe in there alongside, you know, McCarthy. You know, I think Myler, he looks very confident under Bruce this season.
He's doing very well indeed. In quite a winning Hull City side.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he's, he's playing regular football, you know, and I think that's important. And I think it's important that, you know, he's playing at the Premier level as well, Premier League level, which is probably where we want to, you know, where we want to see our players do, you know. Or B, should that be?
It's terrific stuff. I want to bring Ger McCarthy in now on a point. Ger, we're always talking on the Why Big Football Show about every time there's a squad announced, it reminds me of Trapattoni's era that we always seem to highlight, and the papers do as well, the players that aren't in the squad. And of course, your own county man, Stephen Ireland, the prodigal son, who never is short of a few headlines in tabloid newspapers, but he wasn't in the squad. Martin O'Neill stressed the point that he's giving Stephen Ireland time to sort out his club situation. He spoke to him on the phone, and Stephen Ireland is open to a meeting. Now, a lot of Irish fans, pundits and journalists were making the point in the lead up to this squad announcement that Martin O'Neill should just name him in the squad, and if he comes, he comes. If he doesn't, he doesn't.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. I think the whole Stephen Ireland thing, he's the only player I know of in any international squad that there's debate around, is he actually having a chat with the manager first before his selection even comes up for consideration. I think the point O'Neill made earlier in the week was interesting in that he pretty much said that at Stoke, Glenn Whelan is still ahead of him in the pecking order, and that he hasn't really started, I think since early December, he wouldn't have started, or late December, hasn't actually started a first team game. And the way that O'Neill and Keane and his backroom team have been going about their business is that they're picking players on form. They're picking players who are doing well for their clubs and playing regularly. So in that case, Ireland simply doesn't fall into the category of probably coming in for selection just yet. I'll tell you what I actually think. My gut feeling is O'Neill has looked at Ireland, and I think he's had him watched a couple of times, and he's just thought, I'm just wondering, is his arrival worth all the hassle? You saw all the media attention when Roy Keane arrived in as, you know, number one coach or his right-hand man. Could you imagine the media scrum if Ireland was called up for a friendly or even a qualifier? I just think at this stage that if he can't make it into the first team in Stoke, and a Stoke team that's not doing particularly well, if he can't get in ahead of Glenn Whelan in the Stoke team, which I think is a pertinent point, I think O'Neill is just probably looking at it and going, look, unless you actually come in and play five or six games in a row, make an impact, help Stoke move up the table, there's no real question of whether you're going to be back or not. He needs to play well and play regularly first before the furore starts around whether he should be back in the Ireland team to begin with or not. And the boys are right. I think they alluded to you can guarantee a Twitter and an online reaction to his comeback. Personally, I wouldn't care about that. If he's playing well enough and if he can offer something new to the Irish setup, if he can enhance their chances of winning a football match, that's all I care about. But right now, I don't think that's the case.
That's a fair point, Ger. Thanks for that. Ronan, to come back to you, I know Martin O'Neill did make the point that we are quite limited, and he was looking at a lot of the younger players, and the fact that he doesn't feel that ambitious about the amount of young players coming through, which is a little bit concerning. But at the same time, as we were talking about the likes of Eunan O'Kane, perhaps Jack Grealish, who just seems to score more goals, cracking goals for Notts County on loan there from Aston Villa, he looks certain to be a quality player. I think it's probably important that the FAI, they have been treating him well in recent articles I've been and interviews he's been giving, but it's important to have a quality player like that in our ranks and keep him there. Is there players that you feel should have been in the squad?
Well, apart from Duffy that I mentioned earlier, I suppose Jeff Hendrick is probably one that might feel aggrieved at being left out, seeing as how he came into the squad under Trapattoni and he had a good impact, and he looks like the kind of ball-playing midfielder, the heads up looking for a pass that the Irish fans seem to want the style to follow. So I'd imagine that Hendrick would be disappointed. But on your Grealish point, I'm not sure if the time is right for him yet. But the FAI do seem to be doing everything right to kind of keep him happy and keep him playing for Ireland, especially giving him an award last year. That's always good. He didn't get a nod this year.
I was thinking that. I remember him actually at the award. He got the young player under 17s or under 18s or something. As you said, yeah, it's kind of stroking the ego. He's very very happy playing for Ireland, Ronan, and the point he makes the point that he's that England, the English FA have been in contact with him, and they are trying to get him to join their ranks, and that he would be in they offered him a place in their under 19s team, but at the same time he said it's a higher level playing for the Irish under 21s than it would be, say, the English under 19s. Are we in danger of losing him?
I wouldn't think so myself, not at the moment anyway. He seems contented here, but maybe when a higher level England team starts sniffing around him, we might need to fast track him into the senior setup. But until then, I'd say we're safe enough.
Okay, that's reassuring to hear there, Ronan. Thanks a million for that. Trevor Keane, Andy Reid, I'm always raving about him on this show. It's ridiculous. Captain of Norwich, scoring goals, setting up goals. He's an unstoppable force this year. I recently put out an Irish starting 11 and I had him in it. Should we be building the team around a player like that?
I could go against popular opinion here. I mean, I do like Andy Reid, and I'm glad to see him, you know, in the Ireland squad, and I'm glad to see him, you know, he's been playing very well for Forest, and, you know, it was great to see him get rewarded with a contract. So, you know, I just want to put that caveat in there. But, I mean, building a team around, you know, a 30-year-old, I don't know if that's the approach to take. I mean, just going I mean, using the Reid against Ireland point, I mean, I'd much rather have Reid in there. I mean, he's always someone that has wanted to play for Ireland, you know, as opposed to Ireland, who's kind of, you know, giving out mixed signals. And, you know, just I would be indifferent to his return. It wouldn't bother me. But I think Reid is somebody that deserves to be in there. Whether I'd build a team around him or not, I don't think so. I definitely think he can have an impact for Ireland, but I would prefer to see maybe someone like McGeady or tried in the kind of hole, or even Pilkington, who hasn't really had, I suppose, given a chance for Ireland due to his own problems, really, where he's pulled out of a lot of squads. But, you know, I don't think Reid, he can certainly make an impact for Ireland, but I don't think he's the I don't think he's the answer to you know, to build the future of Irish.
Yeah, me looking through my green tinted goggles, Trevor, I'm probably thinking of Italy with Pirlo and that kind of thing. You know, when you can have a player and you can put him in a position where he doesn't need to do that much running, but kind of pull the strings, the kind of himself or Wes Houlihan. A pity about Wes Houlihan's club career at the moment, but that's the kind of area I was going down. But do you feel that international football at his age is a little bit risky?
No, I don't think it's risky. I mean, I mean, you know, I suppose to be clear, I suppose Ireland and Italy are at very different, you know, levels in international football. You know, certainly on our day we can compete, you know, in one off with them. But I mean, the Italian approach is probably, you know, built around putting a player in and give him that freedom to sit back and not do the tracking. Whereas, you know, the Irish team, you know, we have to work harder to get the ball, and we don't have the ball, we have to work harder to win it back. And when we have the ball, we have to work even harder to create something. So I'm not sure if O'Neill would see, you know, having a player of unbelievable talent, you know, but just, you know, allowing him that kind of, you know, freedom to not to fall into a kind of a more rigid, you know, tactical discipline, you know.
I think just on that, I wouldn't disagree with what Trevor said there. But when it comes to Andy Reid, the one thing I think he still has, more so than the midfielder, when you look at the midfielders that Ireland have to choose from, the likes of Glenn Whelan, McLean, McGeady, McCarthy, Gibson, Quinn, Green, Moyler even, and even Pilkington, who, as Trevor rightly said, we haven't seen enough of yet to form a proper opinion at international level. One thing Reid still does have, in my opinion, at international level that he could help us with is dead ball delivery from corners and from free kicks. He's been doing it consistently for Nottingham Forest this year. I've watched a lot of him. And the thing with Reid is, I don't think the stamina is there at the highest international level to last 90 minutes or to make a serious impact. But with Wes Houlihan in and out of the team, with some of the players that I mentioned, they're not nailing down a first team place. And when you have two central midfielders like some McCarthy, maybe even Green, Darren Gibson when he's fit, remember, would be coming into the central midfielder, I like the fact that Reid can flit between a front two or out wide, maybe not as well as Houlihan, but he can still play that role. I still think he has something to offer as a squad player. And if you're chasing a game, which more often than not Ireland are these days, dead ball situations, corners and free kicks have become absolutely crucial for Ireland, not just defending them, but actually scoring from them. And I think his delivery, I think his consistency this year for Forest has surprised me. I watched him very closely when he was at Spurs, and he dropped, his weight dropped, and when his weight dropped, his performances were superb in his heyday at Tottenham. The same is true now at Nottingham Forest.
He's having probably the best point in his career in a long time.
Yeah, and it's not a coincidence, the fact that he's looking a lot slimmer and able to make up the ground and cover the ground. Now, Championship and Premiership, there's a big difference, and there's an even bigger difference between Championship and international football. So I take the point, but I would still look at him. It's when I look at Andy Reid and when I look around him in the international options that Martin O'Neill has, I still think he has a role to play. Maybe not 90 minutes in an important qualifier, but certainly he's somebody that you could bring on as a sub or play in a number of roles, and that might be useful. And you can't say that about all the Irish midfielders that are currently in there. So I still think he has something to offer.
Okay, just a final point there to Ronan before we wrap up, lads. I have to put this to you guys. Looking at the team that Martin O'Neill has selected, and it's quite a difficult scenario if I'm asking you to pick just a sample starting 11 or the type of team that you'd like to start that match. But Ronan, I'll give you the duty to name it, and I'll see if the lads can pick holes in your formula there. So if you just want to go from goalkeepers, would you stick with Ford?
I'd say O'Neill will probably stick with Ford, just because it's unlikely that Westwood is going to be back anytime soon. So I suppose Ford needs all the first-team experience with the Irish setup that he can get. But I'd imagine he might bring on someone half time or during the second half might give Elliot a run out, as I was saying earlier.
And yet, defenders, you've got Kelly Keogh, Wilson, Coleman, O'Shea, Dunn, Pearce, Delaney, Clark and Ward to choose from. Who will he go for?
Well, he's guaranteed to start Coleman on the right now. If he doesn't, I'd say he'd be out with a job the day after the match.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, the middle pairing, that could be an interesting one, all right. I'd say Clark will probably line up in the centre, perhaps, and he can go with John O'Shea, a more experienced head, maybe alongside him, and Wilson maybe left back to give him another run out there rather than Ward, I'd say.
Okay, midfielders, McCarthy, Whelan, Green, Myler, McGeady, Pilkington, McLean, Quinn, Houlihan and Reid.
It's an interesting one because it depends on what formation he's going for, of course. So, Whelan and McCarthy sitting deep, I'd say. McGeady and Pilkington will probably get the nods on the wing. Well, as long as Pilkington stays fit until the match, of course. And I'd say he might give Houlihan a try in the hole.
Okay, fair enough. And forwards, an area that we have been weakened in. Robbie Keane isn't there. We've got Daryl Murphy making his return to the Irish squad. Shane Long firing on all cylinders and with assists as well at new club Hull City. Jonathan Walters, Kevin Doyle, Simon Cox and Anthony Stokes.
It's hard to look past Long. I know it's nice to have Murphy back in the squad, but I'd say not more than a cameo role at the end of the game. And Doyle, I wouldn't be too confident of him getting a run out at all. And like I was saying earlier, he could be one of the players that could be cut. So I'd definitely go for Long because it's his chance now to actually cement the starting position for him up front.
Okay, interesting team. Trevor, what would your team be if you were Martin O'Neill and you were using this Serbia friendly to see a good performance, but also to get an idea of who you're going to have in the qualifiers? So if you just want to hit us with your best 11 out of that pick.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with I'd agree with pretty much the choices of Ronan there. The only thing I would maybe like to see, and I can probably be a small bit traditional here, but I'd like to see a Stokes and Long kind of just up front together and just see how that partnership would develop. I mean, Stokes is kind of, you know, he's been in good form this season, and it'd be interesting to see if he got a run at international level. I mean, he's worked hard in the last few games for Ireland that he's got a chance. So I think that would be good. And I mean, I think you're right. I think maybe Wilson might shift to left back, you know, instead of Ward. I've never been the biggest fan of Ward. I just think he's leaves too many gaps there at the back. So probably Wilson offers a bit more sturdiness, unless he wants to keep him in the centre and have Troy Clark at left back. But yeah, I mean, O'Shea and Coleman are must. Ford will probably get the nod. Be good to see one of the other two get a chance second half. And I think Pilkington, if he gets on the plane over from England, will start. And yeah, I'd agree with the rest.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, straightforward enough. I think Ford has to start. I think he's the number one keeper. I don't like all this talk that's been happening around Shea Given possibly coming back. I think that's kind of unnerving for him. I think he's justified his selection in the previous internationals. I think he deserves a long run in the team. The back four, the only thing I'd say about the back four, Wilson from Stoke, I think has to become one of our number one centre-back. I don't want him playing anywhere else now. Coleman's a lock at right-back. Damien Delaney as well from Crystal Palace has been playing really consistently, especially since Pulis has taken over. Maybe not at centre-back, but possibly left-back with Richard Dunn coming into the middle or else John O'Shea. But I'm not really that bothered about who he plays there, but I want Wilson centre-back. I don't want him full-back. The midfield across the four, I agree with Trevor and Ronan there that I think Pilkington, if he can manage not to break his leg between the airport and the ground, it would be nice to see him and leave him on for as long as possible and let him get a feel for it. Myler at Hull City as well, not because he's from Cork, but because he's been playing pretty well this year, better than I thought he would under Steve Bruce. I think deserves a look in the centre midfield, if only to see can he, like, as a backup to Whelan and McCarthy, who I think are locks in those centre midfield positions. After that, he knows what he's going to get from McLean. He knows what he's going to get from McGeady. So let's have a look at Houlihan out wide. Let's have a look at Reid out wide and see what they can do. Up front, I disagree with the lads on Stokes. I think Stokes has had his chance at Irish international level. I don't think he's delivered. He's playing for Celtic week in, week out and scoring a lot of goals, but it's a substandard league. And at international level, when he did appear recently, I was really disappointed with him and with his effort. So in, having said that, I think the likelihood is that Long and Doyle up front is who I would prefer to see, simply because Doyle is scoring goals for QPR. He needs a run back in the international team for his confidence. And I think he do himself and Long are used to playing with each other. And I think that would be beneficial, especially against a quality opposition like Serbia. And if not, then maybe Walters up front. Daryl Murphy, no, I don't think so. I just... He doesn't do it for me.
Okay, he doesn't do it for you. Just before I let you go, I can't just sit here and not give my own team. I picked it earlier and I had Ford in goals, defenders, Coleman. I had O'Shea and Dunn in the middle and stuck Wilson out left. And I take Jer's point, Wilson should be now a centre-back. But I think it was more of a less of a risk putting Wilson out left than bringing back Ward in. Midfielders, I had Pilkington and McGeady on the wings with McCarthy and Myler in the centre, with Andy Reid playing off Shane Long up front, Shane Long on his own. So that's that. My thanks indeed to Ger McCarthy, Ronan Murphy and Trevor Keane for joining me on the Why Big Football Show. I'll chat to you again, lads. Thanks a million and enjoy the game.
You're listening to the Why Big Football Show on Freak FM. Get involved with the show. Email dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook. Chat to you soon. Well, you're welcome back to the Why Big Football Show on Freak FM. Now, a few months ago, we featured Marco Sullivan on the show talking about grassroots football in Sweden and how it excelled in recent years. We asked the question that day, if Irish youth soccer is lagging behind the rest of Europe and what we can do to fix it. Well, I'm delighted to be joined on the Why Big Football Show by UEFA coach Antonio Mantero, author of the Coach Diary football blog. Antonio, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about the Coach Diary and how it came about.
I suppose I set it up really because I was researching on how to improve my coaching criteria. A lot of people that get into coaching kind of got in through a friend of a friend with absolutely no experience. So I was put in front of, you know, 16 kids, basically knowing nothing about coaching. I knew a lot about football, but I knew nothing about coaching football. So it was a fairly daunting experience. I thought screaming and shouting and running up and down the sideline, you know, commanding and directing was the way to coach. And the day I got sent off was the day that I decided to kind of change and research coaching and try and become a better coach. And that's kind of what started the Coach Diary blog. I just started researching about European football in general and coaching in Europe, and it kind of just kind of escalated from there.
Yeah, when you said you were sent off from a match, and was it a case that, you know, when tempers are running high, you're not in your right frame of mind? And was there a little bit of a realization that day that, okay, well, maybe I'm not doing it the way I should be?
Yeah, because what I know now is that you know, the very best coaches are great observers, so they're able to control themselves on the line, and they're able just to stand and watch and observe and take notes. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it was just the simple fact that I just didn't know what I was doing, and I thought, you know, screaming and shouting at kids and directing them was a way of me showing them that I knew what I was doing, and you know, showing again that I was kind of in control. So it was almost kind of like a power thing that I had kind of control over them by being loud and boisterous. But, you know, I clearly didn't even know what I was doing.
Well, you spent a lot of time in Portugal, I was reading. Did you find a big difference to their approach to youth football over there to what you've found here in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, the approach there is very much, you know, you start with small sort of games. You also start with a lot of indoor football. So you don't tend to play a lot of, you don't move on to kind of, you know, grass football pitches. Well, in Portugal, it was kind of sandy pitches. You wouldn't move on to playing in a sandy pitch until you were about, you know, maybe under 11 or under 12. And up until that age, you generally are playing indoors. So you're playing futsal quite a lot. So whether it's an outdoor futsal pitch or an indoor hall, that's really what you start with. So you're starting with, I suppose, smaller footballs, you know, lots of touches, very, very tight spaces. So, you know, it's making you think really, really quickly, and you don't have much time to kind of receive a pass, you know, either play another one or dribble. So, yeah, it's very much different in that sense. I suppose here, you know, we have an attitude with trying to get kids onto the big 11-a-side pitch as quick as possible, you know. So, you know, it's just the way that I suppose we've kind of been brought up, that we tend to kind of push kids before their time. So we're trying to push kids, you know, ahead and try to push them onto 11-a-side pitches, you know, before they've even mastered, I suppose, the small side of game, or mastered, you know, dribbling and passing the ball and that kind of thing. So also in Portugal, they tend to encourage 1v1 in all parts of the pitch. So, you know, they would not say to you, look, don't dribble there, because you shouldn't dribble in your defensive half. You should always dribble in your attacking half. So they would never say that to you. You know, they tell you to dribble everywhere. They tell you to go and take players on 1v1. The only difference is, they do ask, if you lose the ball, you work hard to win it back. That's kind of different here. You know, we kind of ridicule kids who try tricks or who try to dribble in the defensive half. And we say, don't do that there. You only do that up there near the box, kind of thing, you know, which is, you know, again, it's kind of putting adult kind of ideas onto kids. And really, we should be just letting kids make those decisions for themselves, and they'll figure it out where they should dribble and where they shouldn't dribble, and, you know, when to do it and when not to do it.
Yeah, it's all about decision making. And when you were saying about the Irish kids getting upgraded to 11-a-side pitches very early, it was reminding me of, I remember reading one time where Spanish football, Puyol, apparently he hadn't played on 11-a-side football until the age of 15 or 16, which was really remarkable. Now, you're obviously huge into coaching and the various techniques that are there. No doubt you've seen a lot of different coaching styles. On your blog, you talk a lot about the Iberian style of play, probably the most mostly widely promoted style of play. Is it the best, though?
Is it the best? I think probably at this current time, I would say it is the best. If you look at how Spanish teams are dominating, okay, you know, bear in mind there are some foreigners there, but most of them are Spanish, you know, of Spanish descent. If you look at the coaching in terms of the best coaches in the world, most of them are Spanish or Portuguese. So I think, yeah, I think at this current moment in time, it is dominating. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of young kids coming through. Actually, you know, maybe you're not that young, because in Portugal and Spain, they don't tend to push the young kids into full-size kind of professional football until quite late. So, you know, they let them develop a little bit more. As for, you know, in England and that, they tend to push kids a little bit quicker. So they'll push a 19-year-old into playing for Chelsea at a very young age, you know, whether he's kind of ready for it or not. But just to get back to your question, yeah, I think it is. I think it is dominating. I think they've a great way of teaching, and they've a great way of keeping a philosophy from the very young ages all the way up to the senior team, whether that be in club football or whether that be in international football. But if you look at the best academies in the world, you know, the top one is probably, you know, Barcelona, or we'll say Ajax is probably the top one. But after that, you've got Barcelona is probably the third, Sporting Club Portugal is probably up there as well. So Barca second, Sporting probably third. And they're constantly producing, you know, players to move them on into senior football, or else they move on to bigger teams. And they've also produced more World Player of the Years than any other club. So, yeah, I would think they are kind of dominating at the moment.
It's quite interesting. I know that style of play, the philosophy. I remember seeing a couple of American football academies. They've kind of bought into this as well. There's a couple of YouTube videos on where the kids are just purely playing this passing football, build it, patient, all about decision makings, more so than the whole speed and strength side of things. And I just wanted to go back to when you were saying about the culture of coaching and that, and your motto on your website is "Let the kids play." Do you feel that's happening here in Ireland, or is it still a huge emphasis on trying to win games?
I feel it is changing, and I suppose I can only go based by the people that kind of, you know, write to me, or, you know, like kind of post them on my blog or on Facebook. So I'd imagine those people that kind of follow what I do or follow what I write and encourage me to kind of write more and encourage me to keep kind of fighting the change that it is changing. But I suppose for every one person that's changing, there might be another five or four that are actually getting into, starting off getting into coaching the kids that have that mentality of win at all costs. So, yeah, I mean, it is a fighting battle. I would like to think there is changes happening, but, certainly not to the extent that there needs to be. And there definitely needs to be more kind of influence coming from the top. So the FAI need to be influencing a little bit more, kind of coming out with more in relation to the coaching courses need to be more focused around kind of management of kids, around philosophy, around being a teacher and an educator, and not just about putting on drills or game related exercises that kids can do, because coaching is much more than just the technical and tactical aspect of the game. It's really your mentor, really you're educating kids and you're teaching them about life. So winning, of course, it's part of life, and we need to teach kids about winning and losing. But in relation to kids wanting to win, that is something that they'll always have. Kids will always want to win. Whether you put down jumpers on a green or whether they put on a jersey, they'll always want to win. But it's the coach really that kind of influences that. And the winning at all cost mentality is still very much in the Irish game, and it's just something that's, again, that's kind of in us. And again, it boils back down to coach education. It boils back down to, coaching being a professional. And I think if we had more professional type coaching in Ireland, then, the attitude would be different, because you would have people who are researching coaching, who are into coaching, who, see it as a job. So, people who see coaching as a job will generally look and find the right way to coach. And until that kind of happens, we're going to struggle with trying to kind of change people's minds. But yeah, I mean, it is changing, but not to the extent that I feel that's going to help with future development of the kids.
Indeed,
that play the game.
Absolutely, yeah. Antonio. And in terms of change in philosophy, one of the things I always read the Target magazine in the paper, and also the Evening Herald's junior soccer pages, which they have every week. And I do have a general interest in it. But one of the things that I seem to, from watching other documentaries as well, for ambitious players, Irish youngsters at good schoolboy clubs, there seems to be a lot of pressure on them in terms of making it over to England, getting noticed by scouts. You said about players going to Carlisle and Notts Forest and that, and they get trialed, and there's a lot of pressure there. So it probably goes true down the line. That's where we're kind of at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there is a huge pressure. I mean, we're almost, in a sense, going the American way now as well, but we're pushing kids into sport way too early. So you have kids now starting at little kickers and all these kinds of little, rugby and soccer type schools, where kids at the age of 2 and 3 are being pushed into organized sports really, really early. And to be honest, the long term, there's absolutely, and researchers have shown that there's no benefits to pushing kids into sports too early, as in specializing in one sport. In fact, kids who play a multi-sport at a younger age are more beneficial and have more of a chance to actually go and be successful in sport than kids who specialise just in one sport. But yeah, there is pressure on kids and to try and be successful and to go over to England. And the stats again and the percentages of the child being successful from going from Ireland to England it's crazy. I mean, I think it's 0.12%. A chance of a child to go and be successful in England, and something like 87% who receive a first contract never get a second one.
A lot of heartbreak there.
Huge heartbreak. And like, you're talking about 15 and 16 year old boys, sending them over to England away from their family, living in homes with people they don't know, eating food that they don't really like, having a lot of time to themselves. So very different to the culture to where a kid would join an academy, say in Portugal and Spain, where they actually live in the academy along with all the other kids. So it's a much more of a family-based kind of idea. It also keeps the kids much more grounded and, less bored, because they're all together. They do everything together. They've got a full program throughout the day. As for a lot of the kids that now go to England, some of them, are studying via the academies, but a lot of academies in England can't afford to put kids through study, so they kind of have to do that themselves. So it is, it's a huge change for 15 or 16 year olds, and I think we need to focus on keeping our kids here for longer and trying to develop our own league. It's been shown with some of the guys that have gone over to England later that have been more successful by staying here.
Absolutely. Seamus Coleman is a prime example. That extra, he said he could have gone over earlier, but that extra season at Sligo really helped him.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, because he had an opportunity to play, high level football. He had an opportunity to play in Europe as well, so he had an opportunity to experience Europe. You know, he could go over to England and never experience Europe because he might be playing at some of the lower division teams, or say, you know, the lower of the Premier League. So it's all a snowball effect, and eventually it gets down to grassroots, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got a philosophy which is starting at quite a young age, and you're feeding into our League of Ireland team, which in turn is feeding into the Senior League of Ireland team and then into the international team.
Yeah, one of the things I've always thought there, Antonio, is the fact that when English clubs used to come over to Ireland, they always used to go for the strong physical players. And, you know, if they wanted a technical, skillful, very good decision maker, they'd go to the continent. Is that changing? Are English clubs seeing Ireland now as a market for more quality players, with the likes of James McLean and Seamus Coleman, and now, you know, Wes Houlihan at Norwich? There is Irish players that have come through the league here that have a little bit more than just the physicality and the bite that English clubs always kind of came over here for.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, Wes Houlihan, he's only been really getting a chance over the last couple of years since that kind of mentality of, you know, picking the big, strong kid, you know, over the small, more technical one. And, you know, since Spain have dominated the world with small players, technical players that have game intelligence, then, you know, other nations have been looking, okay, well, you know, maybe we need to give these small players a chance. These are the ones that, you know, are the game creators. You know, they've got lower center of gravity. They've got great balance and turn and imagination. Are they looking here? I'm not sure that we are producing those type of players yet, the UK.
Yeah, I think England are having a similar problem in the sense that a lot of their big players are they're big, strong, and fast, but they lack the football intelligence. I know we see kind of few Xavi or Iniesta type players that are actually produced in England. Just a point, you were mentioning about kids and the fact that the kids shouldn't be pushed in too early to a certain sport, and that in fact when they play multi-sports at a young age it seems to benefit them. What age should we be starting the development? Because you know what it's like, every parent wants to live their football career that they never had through their kid, and you know they'll do what they can to promote that, and they'll give them a ball as soon as they're born almost. What age should they really be starting in terms of joining a team and getting the coaching down?
Yeah, I think it's whatever age the child turns around to their mum and dad and goes, you know what, I'd love to go down and play football. So that, I mean, that could happen at 5 or 6, where a child might turn around and go, yeah, I really want to go, and that's fine, you know, bring that child down. But I mean, very few kids at the age of 5 or 6 are turning around to their parents and saying, yeah, I want to go down to little rugby camp, or I want to go down to, you know, little GA camp or soccer camp or whatever it may be. So, you know, if they're not asking, then you don't need to bring them. And the best place for a child to be is actually in the playground, where he's running around, he's moving in different directions, he's jumping off the swing, you know, he's climbing, he's using his body weight to get through the monkey bars, he's pulling himself up, he falls, he picks himself up again. You can't do that in organized sport. Organized sport at a very young age tends to be drills where kids are standing in a line. You're next, you're next, you're next, you're next. That's boring. It's boring for a child to be standing in a line. They'll do it for so long, and then after a while, if they're the type of child, they might turn around to their parents and say, look, I'm not really into this. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of these kids go into academies early. They're so young that they could, you know, they don't have that in them to turn around to their parents. So they don't have that, you know, to be able to turn around to the parents and say, I don't like going. So a lot of parents are saying, oh, well, you know, the neighbor down the road is bringing their kids, so I've got to bring mine. I think the best place for a child at 6, 7, 8 is in the playground. You know, let them go down the playground, let them run around, let them lift their body weight, let them move in different directions. Unless your child is turning around to you and telling you, I want to go down and play that game, then bring them down. Other than that, I wouldn't bring them down. I mean, I have a 6-year-old daughter myself, you know, and I'm, you know, hugely into football. I've never once, you know, looked and go, okay, I'm going to bring her into football because I want her to be a professional footballer. I would love for her to be a professional footballer, but that's up to her. That's her decision. She needs to turn around to me and say, yeah, I'd like to go and play football, or I'd like to go and do this, and I'd like to go and do that. And until she does that, then, you know, I don't feel I need to bring her anywhere. I think it has to be up to the person. And, you know, it boils down to the same whether a child is going to make it or not. Ultimately, it's up to that child to better themselves and push themselves if they want it further on. You know, all the parent can do is guide them and nurture them. But, you know, the decision has to be ultimately up to the child.
Absolutely. I think I remember Roy Keane saying that his kids aren't too interested in playing football at all. It's all video games, but he won't interfere with that at all, you know. It also got me thinking, Antonio, about parents. They're very supportive of their kids, but we do tend to see a lot of YouTube videos now. When you're talking about the drills, I was thinking of this. We'd see YouTube videos now of the next Irish Messi and skillful Irish players. Is that good, the fact that the parents are promoting them, putting them on YouTube and stuff like that? Or does it just grate an expectation, well, if you don't make it to Barcelona, you're going to be a failure or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a difficult one, because in a way it's great. You know, it might be great for a kid because a coach might see it, and in a club, say Barcelona, might see this kid and go, wow, this kid has got talent, let's get him over. You know, and who knows, you know, that might be the start of something. In another way, like you said, you know, it could be the opposite, where you're constantly putting these videos up on YouTube. You know, some of the negative comments that people might put there, you know, as we know, people have a right to say whatever they want and can say whatever they want. So you just don't know how that's affecting the child. And all I can say is that, you know, for any child that wants to be successful, that it has to be ultimately up to the child. I mean, the parents can guide, you know, and lead. And I'm not sure, you know, uploading videos, constant videos on YouTube is going to benefit the child that much, because, again, it's kind of highlighting expectations, and you just don't know where that's going to lead or how that's going to affect that child in the long term.
It'll be interesting to see, because we might see a few more of the Freddie Adu situations, you know. It'll be interesting. Now, you are making huge inroads in changing the mentality, it's fair to say, Antonio. I know a lot of people are talking about it, and you're re-emphasising the point that coaches need coaching almost, and you set up a terrific initiative called the Silent Sideline. Tell us a little bit about that. It was a case where you just let the kids play and don't shout orders at them, because we do seem to have a culture where there's too many angry parents.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, and through my research and, you know, through reading various books, and whether it be psychology or just on coaching or speaking to, you know, the top coaches, you know, I've learned that, you know, the very best coaches are great observers. So they're able to watch a game, observe it, you know, take notes, and take whatever they find from that game to bring it back to the training ground the next week and work on it.
You've just described Jose Mourinho, I think, the poker face.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose we don't want to mix up the professional coaches with, you know, what the youth coaches do, because it's a completely different job and it's a completely different kind of role. You know, Jose Mourinho gets paid millions of pounds to win games, gets paid millions of pounds to motivate players. You know, so that's his job. His job is to win games, and you know, that's what he gets paid to do. At the youngest level, you know, our job as a coach is to keep kids in sport, and that is your ultimate aim, is to keep that child loving the game and keeping them playing sport. And that's what you do not get paid for, you know, which is unfortunate. But I suppose the Silent Sideline kind of boils back to that, where I see a lot of parents and a lot of kids at the weekend, a lot of coaches at the weekend, you know, screaming 5, 6, 7 different instructions at a child as they're about to receive the ball or as they're about to pass it. You know, that is having a detrimental effect on that child's development. You know, it's making them play with fear. It's making them not make decisions for themselves. Every time they might receive the ball, they might look to the line for direction on what to do. So it's almost, you know, it's got to the stage, and I think Mark might have touched on this the last time you spoke to him, that it's almost got to the stage where kids, you know, playing almost feel that they need adults to kind of bring them along, and they feel that the adults need to be involved in absolutely everything in order for them to develop, and that is not the case. You know, the best way for kids to develop is to develop by themselves.
Yeah.
You know, guided by us, nurtured by us, within, you know, a team environment where they're making decisions for themselves, where they're making mistakes and they're learning by it, and they're not getting ridiculed for it on the line. So the idea behind a Silent Sideline is it's a weekend where kids, where adults and parents will just stand back and just let the kids play. There'll be absolutely no direction from the line. The only direction that the coach can give is, you know, for substitutes, if they're making changes and decisions at halftime, you know, they can give the direction on what they feel needs to be done in relation to the game and that kind of stuff. But in terms of during the game, I'm asking for coaches and parents just to stand back and just let the kids play, you know, let them make decisions for themselves, let them enjoy the game. Let's hear kids' voices all over the football pitch, and let's you know, try and allow kids to play with freedom. And really, that's kind of the idea at the weekend. It's just really letting kids play and letting them enjoy. And now, it probably will seem a little bit weird for the kids not hearing all these adults and that shout at them, but look, it's something that just going to have to adapt to. And you know, certainly, you know, the referees will certainly backing this, as I know they are already. And it's certain that, you know, again, you know, the abuse that some of the referees get, and it's generally some of the reasons why games are kind of abandoned is because of the abuse from adults towards referees.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before I let you go, Antonio, I have to ask you what you hope will change in the next few years. I know at the current time there seems to be a lot of arguments over the structure of schoolboy leagues here in Ireland with the DDSL and that. And do you believe maybe League of Ireland clubs can be playing a greater role? I mean, we've seen for the first time now Shamrock Rovers with an academy and being able to field two teams in the League of Ireland. What would your hope now going forward be?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the hope would be from the ground up to have a philosophy and a methodology that's being carried throughout the whole of Ireland, so that we're all singing from the same hymn sheet. So, you know, we roll something out and every club, every league and every club within that league, you know, is carrying the same philosophy. So it's really not about the individual club, but it's about a country, it's about a nation, it's about developing kids for the future, with the attitude of keeping those kids in sport. If something, you know, if we can develop kids to move them into, say, senior football, then that is fantastic. That is the bonus. But our focus should be to keep kids in sport, and our focus should be to have a method that's carried throughout the whole of Ireland. I'd like to see futsal maybe introduced over the months of winter, so say from November to February, where there's been very few games played because of weather. You know, there's an opportunity to introduce indoor football, which is futsal. So I think that can only enhance and develop the kids' ability, technical ability, game intelligence even more. And like you mentioned, just, you know, League of Ireland clubs should really have an academy. So they should have academies that are feeding from a very young age all the way into the senior team. And I know Rovers and Shelburne all kind of had academies before, and it was really just to do with their license. So they needed to have an academy to get a license. But really, I can see now that some of them are now really starting to try and, you know, make it where the academies are actually connected, really connected to the clubs, and they're looking at feeding kids from the under 17s, under 18s, under 19s into the second team or into the first team. You know,
it's exciting stuff. The website is thecoachdiary.com. It's a terrific read. Antonio Montero, thanks a million for joining us on the Why Big Football Show, and we look forward to chatting to you again.
Great, thanks a lot. And just the Silent Island weekend is the 29th and 30th of March. So if anybody wants to get involved, you know, they can just email or go onto the blog. So info@thecoachdiary.com.
Fantastic thanks stuff. Thanks, Antonio. Antonio Montero there, and that's it for the Why Big Football Show this week. That was our first show on Freak FM. Delighted to be here. Tell us what you think. You can tweet at Freak FM, or you can tweet myself at The World's Talking, or just search for Dave O'Grady on Twitter and let us know what you thought of the show. We'll be back at the same time next week, 10 o'clock on Tuesday. From myself, Dave O'Grady, and my guests, have a very good evening.